Despite last week's better-than-expected jobs numbers, unemployment remains well over 7%, and many Americans are worried about the fact that China's economic growth is exceeding ours. Americans also worry about how politically divided the country is. But at the start of the Great Depression 80 years ago, the economy was worse, our global competitors more threatening, and the divide, well, how political divisions have changed is still open to question. Ira Katznelson, professor of political science and history at Columbia University, has written a sweeping study of the New Deal and its politics called Fear Itself, The New Deal and the Origins of Our Time. It's published by Liveright Imprint at Norton, and I'm very pleased that it brings Professor Katznelson to our show today. Hello.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Now, your book's official publication date was March 4th, the 80th anniversary of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's first inaugural speech, and your title invokes his famous line, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." FDR called that fear unjustified, but wouldn't his references to fear have been more than rhetoric in 1933?
Yes, indeed. I think Franklin Roosevelt misled the American people in that sense, deliberately. He sought to assuage the people. He sought to calm fear. He sought not to be a demagogue. But at the same time, there were deep reasons for being fearful at the time.
Well, hadn't the Nazis burned the Reichstag just a few days before?
Yes, indeed. The context within which the New Deal came to power was a context in which many democracies, both in Europe and Latin America, most spectacularly in Germany, had collapsed. And that collapse created a framework within which the New Deal took off, a framework within which the very question of the capacity of democracy to solve big problems and succeed was put at issue.
Had the phrase, it can't happen here, already been formulated, or was that something that came later?
It came a bit later, but it could happen here was on everybody's mind, including Walter Lippmann's, America's leading journalist, who devoted a series of columns the month before Roosevelt took office, devoted those columns to the theme of the incapacity, potentially, of American democracy and the need to create new constitutional arrangements, potentially, to solve big problems.
Well, Mussolini was already firmly ensconced in Italy, but were people aware that Hitler was another thing entirely?
Yes, indeed they were. And it's precisely because they understood that Hitler was something else that many Americans had affection for Mussolini, thought he would be a bulwark against something significantly less good.
In that inaugural address, FDR called the U.S. a stricken nation in the midst of a stricken world. So he wasn't just addressing the Depression. He really was thinking about, what was going on in Germany mostly. Yeah. Hitler had, there was a Reichstag fire. On that day or right afterward, didn't Hitler wind up being appointed chancellor?
Well, Hitler was appointed chancellor on the 31st of January.
Oh, so earlier.
Some weeks before. But just 19 days later, the Reichstag voted to yield to Hitler and his cabinet all legislative capacity. That is, he could then rule by executive power.
In effect, making him a dictator.
Making him a dictator. And one of the forgotten features of Roosevelt's first inaugural came at the end, in the last paragraphs, in which he said, "I will now ask Congress to pass a variety of laws to meet the emergency, but if they do not, I will then ask for the one remaining power, the ability to rule by executive authority."
And over the course of his time in office, Roosevelt was often accused of wanting to become something of a dictator. And that was exacerbated by the fact that he served more than two terms.
Well, the great feature of the New Deal, from my perspective, is that he never did become a dictator. Congress never was suspended. The ordinary rules of the game remained intact, even under conditions of a layering of fear and emergency.
Although there were some times when perhaps the rules were broken a bit, as we had seen earlier with Abraham Lincoln and the suspension of habeas corpus.
I think the Roosevelt years witnessed going up to and sometimes just over the line, but never erasing the line entirely, as was true of the various dictatorships of the period.
Now, you said that this was the New Deal period from the start. Now, the New Deal didn't start until a while after FDR was in office. What period do you consider the New Deal era?
In the book, I treat the New Deal as a full 20-year period from the inauguration of Franklin Roosevelt to the inauguration of Dwight Eisenhower 20 years later.
With a lot of ups and downs along those lines.
Yes, indeed. Ups and downs and transformations and points of inflection. But having said that, there was something coherent about the whole period of 20-year democratic rule, a layering of emergencies, beginning with the collapse of capitalism, moving through the challenge of the dictatorships, the great violence of the Second World War, atomic weapons, the experience and learning about the Holocaust, the Cold War. And that layering produced recurring sets of fears, so much so that E.B. White wrote to the Herald Tribune as late as 1947, "I live in an age of fear." And it's the implications of living in an age of fear that I wished to make central to my treatment of the New Deal era.
Now, you include Eisenhower's time in office in the New Deal, despite the fact that, to some degree, he saw himself as the person who was going to stop all of the changes of the New Deal?
I mean,
for example, universal health care was proposed at the time, and he dismissed it as creeping socialism.
I stop just as he's inaugurated, but the powerful, continuous features of the Eisenhower administration should not be forgotten. By 1952, the United States had developed a new national state with two faces, like the Roman god Janus. On one side, we had a new interest group-centered state that in which different groups competed for the largesse of the federal government. And on the other side, we had a new national security state, a state strong on a sense of public interest but weak on restraint and procedures. And the Eisenhower administration continued and developed, albeit with some reservations, both of those features of the new American state.
My guest is Ira Katznelson, who's Columbia University's Ruggles Professor of Political Science and History, President of the Social Science Research Council and Research Associate at Cambridge University Center for History and Economics. His latest book is called Fear Itself, The New Deal and the Origins of Our Time, published by LiveWrite. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You describe the New Deal as the most painted political landscape of 20th century America. Now, you're being metaphorical there when using the word painted, I'm assuming.
Yes, indeed.
But more than the Cold War?
I think so. If you go to any library and punch in the words New Deal, thousands upon thousands of work come in. And the Cold War, the beginning of the Cold War, I incorporate within the frame of the 20-year New Deal. So in speaking metaphorically that way, I was giving myself some license.
How has the New Deal typically been described?
Typically, the New Deal is described as beginning with the capitalist collapse or an attempt to address the capitalist collapse and ending either in the late 1930s with the last domestic major piece of legislation, the Fair Labor Standards Act, minimum wage, maximum hours, 1938, or in some hands, it's carried on up to or just after the Second War. But what's critical to most conventional or familiar descriptions is that they describe Roosevelt as grappling successfully with fear, so that by 1936, as the great historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. put the point, Americans were no longer fearful. From my perspective, that truncates the New Deal both temporally and in terms of the sense of fear.
Well, we definitely had fear. I remember when I was in school and I had to climb under my desk into a ball because that was going to somehow save me from an atomic attack.
And you probably wore a dog tag, as did I, in school.
Yes. Are the political dynamics that produced the New Deal just as important as the programs themselves?
I think they are. I think what was critical was how the New Deal, through Congress, sought to address the layerings of fear. You know, fear is different than ordinary risk. Fear is shaped by the creation of deep anxiety in circumstances where we find it difficult, if not impossible, to assess probabilities. And during the period of the 1930s and 1940s, the American people were confronted with, over and over, with sources of fear in which they could not assess probabilities. And our politics did successfully maintain and contain those fears within normal procedures.
And you write, of the New Deal's many achievements, none was more important than the demonstration that liberal democracy, a political system with the legislature at its heart, could govern effectively in the face of danger.
Indeed. And
they're starting to wonder whether that's still true.
Well, there indeed lay both the biggest achievement and the greatest irony. In that period, as today, many Americans, friends of democracy, as well as then the enemies of democracy, argued that ordinary politics could not solve big problems. Polarization, money in politics, strong ideology, the fact that there was no keen sense of shared public interest. And what did take place in this period was a showing that Congress could solve those problems, but with the ironic twist that if not for the least liberal part of the American polity, the American South, which was roughly half the Democratic Party in Congress, those problems could not have been addressed.
And I want to get to that in just a moment, but I was wondering if people had doubts about American democracy, what did they imagine might take its place?
There was quite a range of speculations. I mentioned Lippmann earlier. He simply argued that for a year or two, Congress should be suspended and the executive should have a right to proceed. Others believed that what was needed was uncommon powers of surveillance of the American people to root out evil, Nazis, communists, and others who were supporters of anti-democratic forces.
And that happens again and again. We've had a similar situation in recent years in response to 9/11.
Indeed.
Another time of fear.
One of the central motivations for writing this book was my wish to come to terms with the connections between fear and democracy and how democracies in fearful conditions might well confront fear and a deep anxiety and whether they can do so without lapsing into illiberal, undemocratic practices.
Well, there were a lot of people who were attracted to undemocratic practices, probably most famous today, Charles Lindbergh, Henry Ford sympathizing with the Nazis. Others found Mussolini's fascist Italy appealing, and there were a fair number of people who admired Soviet communism. Do you think that the issue was more the appeal of authoritarian regimes or fears about the vulnerability of American democracy?
I think both together. The various regimes of the period, fascist Italy, Nazi Germany, Stalinist Soviet Union, had appeal as, quote, better democracies, more direct democracies. They represented or they claimed to represent the people in a distinctive form, the race in Germany, the nation in Italy, the class, the working class in the Soviet Union, without having to go through the procedural hurdles of a liberal democracy.
Well, Mussolini presented himself as the spokesperson for the Italian people. He was kind of their voice. Some of fascism's advocates were warmly received in the United States. Can you tell us about Italo Balbo?
Italo Balbo was Minister of Aviation in Mussolini's government, a pilot who led an armada of 24 seaplanes hopscotching across the Atlantic to arrive ultimately in Chicago. Along the way, he received telegrams from Adolf Hitler in every stop, congratulating him for representing Nazism, really fascism, and there indirectly Nazism. He arrived in Chicago to a ticker tape parade of 1 million people when a street was renamed in his honor. Balbo and Michigan is now a great corner downtown.
Still.
Still, absolutely still, remains so. Balbo then flew on to New York, where he was greeted with a ticker tape parade of 2 million, and on to Washington, where he was a guest of Franklin and Eleanor at the White House.
Despite the fact that everybody knew he was representing fascism and Nazism?
He was seen in the context of Lindbergh's flight across the Atlantic as a technological hero and as a person who represented possibilities for effective use of technology in a modern age.
When we talk about this time, do we have to define terms that we think we understand today? For example, the word liberal and liberalism?
Yes, we do. And the word liberal was used then, before Franklin Roosevelt took office, in the tradition of John Locke and John Stuart Mill as connoting a regime of liberty.
Franklin but Roosevelt, also what today we might call libertarianism to some degree.
It included that. Franklin Roosevelt deliberately used the term in a more partisan sense to describe his New Deal. And immediately, former President Herbert Hoover said, "You can't do that. The word liberal belongs to all of us. It belongs to me and to Republican conservatives as well." So it was the hegemonic term, hegemony it's now lost.
And then the L word became synonymous for a time with sympathy to communism in some circles. And more recently, Democrats on the left have rejected the word because it has taken on a whole other meaning, and they want to call themselves progressives.
That's true. It's fascinating how the language of politics alters under different conditions. But the American polity remains, in the old sense, a liberal polity.
My guest is Ira Katznelson. His latest book, Fear Itself, The New Deal and the Origins of Our Time, published by Live Right, which is an imprint of Norton. And we will take a little break and come back with more. We'll talk about the Southern Democrats when we come back. We are back with Ira Katznelson, a Columbia University's Ruggles Professor of Political Science and History, and also President of the Social Science Research Council and Research Associate at Cambridge University Center for History and Economics. His latest book, Fear Itself, The New Deal and the Origins of Our Time, published by Live Right, which is an imprint of W.W. Norton. Could we say that there were three major parties in Congress during this period in the 30s?
Yes, we can, or at least quasi-parties, two parties and a quasi-party. The two parties were Republicans and Democrats, but the third party were Southern Democrats.
Now, are the Blue Dog Democrats today in any way the descendants of those Southern Democrats?
Yes, but today's Southern Republicans are, I believe, to be more directly the descendants of those Southern Democrats of the New Deal era.
So we had the Northern Democrats, who we might call liberal Democrats.
Yes.
We had the Republican Party, which had the full spectrum.
Correct.
And then we had the Southern Democrats, people like Strom Thurmond.
Well, the Southern Democrats were themselves heterogeneous. We had, in that period, 17 states in the Union that mandated racial segregation. These were the same states that had practiced chattel slavery on the basis of race before the Civil War, and the same 17 states that on January 1st, 1967, the year that interracial marriage was declared not to be forbidden, it was unconstitutional to forbid interracial marriage, they were the same states. So we had a continuous racial order. Those states elected 34 United States senators, overwhelmingly Democrats, and they elected a disproportionate number of members of the House because they had rules to keep black people out of the electorate, yet those African Americans counted as citizens for the purposes of representation in Congress.
You write that, I'm quoting, the system of Southern white-dominated society played in national politics is the most overlooked theme in almost all previous histories of the New Deal. Is this what you call the Southern cage?
I do indeed. I think the Roosevelt administration and the American public as well as Congress, were trapped, as it were, within this metaphorical cage. Nothing, I repeat, nothing could pass Congress in the 1930s and 1940s against the wishes of Southern Democrats.
So they had to go along with the New Deal.
They had to go along, and when they chose not to go along, the outcome was different.
So, but concessions had to be made.
The concessions were made all the time. In the 1930s, every single piece of major New Deal legislation, like the Social Security Act or the Wagner Act that chartered a course for organized labor, excluded farm workers and maids at the insistence of Southern Democrats, because those were the jobs that black Americans did in the South. They worked the land and they worked in white people's houses.
So concessions were made to the Southern Democrats. What concessions did they make?
The Southerners, one has to remember, represented a dirt poor region in this period. Average incomes in the South were half those of the rest of the country. Only 30% of farmers in the South, including white farmers, simultaneously or at once had running water, sanitation, and electricity in their homes. This was a third world country. And therefore, the Southerners liked federal programs, federal spending, even high taxes, because they weren't going to be paying them directly from within the South.
In the current debate, there are people who say that people in Congress who hold fast to their ideals, whatever those ideals are really holding things up. Well, we look at this situation and we see that concessions were made. Some of those concessions seem to be rather awful.
Yes, they were. They also were probably inevitable in the sense that we shouldn't look back and just do a morality tale. If we wished to have a Wagner Act, if we wished to have a Social Security Act or minimum wages and maximum hours, at that moment, those bills could not have passed without concessions to the Jim Crow South.
There's a new book out that deals with FDR's role with people who were trying to escape the Holocaust.
Yes,
and
indeed.
We see similar explanations for why some deals were made.
It's a very good book, FDR and the Jews, though I have some reservations about the degree to which it's fair-minded. That is, I think it's possible simultaneously to underscore the arrangements made under conditions of moral challenge and judge them, but judge them not as if there were many choices available to the political leaders at the time.
Well, could FDR have held to a harder line on some of these issues? Was it that even within his thinking? For example, about segregation, because the way that period is generally presented to us, Eleanor was the liberal in that household, and FDR was something of an elitist himself.
We have little evidence that FDR cared anything like the way Eleanor cared about issues of racial justice. But we need to remember that throughout this whole period, not one Southern member of Congress, including such liberals as Claude Pepper, a hero of mine, not one Southern member ever spoke out against segregation. This was seen almost as if a fact of nature. It was not being challenged by Republicans either at this period. There were some bills introduced about lynching, but even those bills were understood to be wholly symbolic statements by Northern Democrats.
Kind of the sort of thing we see today with gun control proposals.
Something like that.
And was the reason that it wasn't challenged because it was understood that if you challenged it, you were going to lose re-election?
No, not to lose re-election, but without Southern members of Congress, you simply couldn't pass the bills that you most cherished.
Did corporate America also play a role in shaping the New Deal?
Yes, corporate America on the whole, which was in bad shape in terms of its legitimacy politically, given the collapse of capitalism, many figures in corporate America rallied to the New Deal, including the New Deal's most radical programs, like the National Industrial Recovery Act, which gave Franklin Roosevelt great power over the whole of the American economy.
What was the reaction to legislation like Glass-Steagall?
It was uneven in the community, but it was understood that it might be necessary to recreate a legitimate framework for capitalism to function. We should remember that the first head of the Securities and Exchange Commission was Joseph Kennedy, a man who'd made his money speculating on Wall Street. And when he stepped down, he pronounced, "I can't invest in Wall Street anymore. I've taken away the gimmicks that I could use to speculate successfully."
Now, getting back to your title, World War II, the Holocaust, nuclear weapons have had lasting influences on Americans and American culture. But did they shape the New Deal era?
I think they shaped the New Deal era by fashioning or making it necessary to fashion a new kind of national security state of a sort that the United States had never had, even in the First World War. This was now to be a permanent national security state with institutions including the newly built Pentagon, National Security Council, the Central Intelligence Agency, and on and on. And that, too, was a product of the New Deal era.
My guest is Ira Katznelson. His latest book, Fear Itself, The New Deal and the Origins of Our Time. Well, your descriptions of the war and post-war years suggest some striking parallels with today. You describe the prosecution of German nationals in the U.S. for sabotage in 1947, for example, which has been held as a reason for doing something similar at Guantanamo.
Well, this period...
He used the word unlawful enemy combatants, didn't he, FDR?
He did indeed. He set the stage when when saboteurs arriving on submarines were caught. They were not tried in ordinary courts. They were tried in 1941 by a special court convened at the Department of Justice and prosecuted by the Attorney General of the United States with rules that were not the ordinary rules of jurisprudence.
But that precedent stands today because it was never challenged in the courts?
It was held by the courts.
In 1938, the House created a special committee to investigate un-American activities. It was renamed the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1945, and its first chair was a Democratic representative, Martin Dees of Texas. Did the politics of that committee reflect the dominant conservatism of Southern Democrats and Republicans?
That committee was dominated by Southern Democrats and Republicans.
How many Southern Republicans were there?
In Congress or on the committee? Well, in Congress, after 1938, more than half of the Democratic Party came from the Jim Crow South. Mm-hmm. And in the Senate, after 1940, we had 34 out of 96 United States senators elected from the Jim Crow South. They had more than a veto in the 1940s over public policy. They were the prime movers as leaders in Congress, leaders of committees, including the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Well, we associate the sorts of things that Dees talked about. He made sweeping claims about left-wingers and radicals and the gigantic bureaucracy with Republicans like Joe McCarthy and Richard Nixon and others. Was this a period where things swung from the Democrats to the Republicans?
Well, there was a radical shift in the war years and just after in the rhetoric, concerns, and anxieties of the Southern members of Congress. Before the war, most Southerners were pretty secure in the racial system of the South. They did not expect it to be challenged. During the war, a war against fascism and racism, questions about American practices came to the fore, and especially with the rise of a mass labor movement, the Southerners grew increasingly fearful that the CIO and its priorities would undermine the racial order they cherished so much.
Well, the committee's other co-creator was Samuel Dickstein, who's a representative from New York.
A representative from the Lower East Side. Samuel Dickstein, we now believe we know with the opening of Soviet archives, was actually in the pay of the Soviet Union. His nickname was the Crook. in the archives, because he took something like $1,200 every month, a fortune in those days, and delivered very little.
If anything, he helped create the committee that went after communists.
Yes, though in the period he was chair, the main target was American Nazis.
You have written previously in your book, When Affirmative Action Was White, about how New Deal policies preserve Southern segregationist institutions. Is Fear Itself a natural outgrowth of that previous work?
When Affirmative Action Was White was originally conceptualized as a section of a much larger book on the New Deal, and it outgrew that that place in this book. So, yes, this book grows out of those concerns, but has a larger canvas on which it operates.
And, in fact, you wind up quoting all sorts of people who were not in politics, as because you see that as all part of the American experience?
I think the American experience in this period was so fear-charged that it's important to understand how the society itself was changing as the political system was grappling with those sources of fear.
Well, you write that you believe that we are being tested in similar ways to those of the 30s and 40s. Do you think that both our democracy and our economy are under threat to the same extent that they were during the Depression?
No, not to the same extent, but to a greater extent than they have been for some time. I was struck the other day in reading a column by my colleague Mark Mazower, a superb historian of Europe, in which he wrote, "We should no longer take for granted that the future of Europe lies with democracy." We wouldn't quite say that in the United States. We're quite sure our future lies with democracy. But whether our democracy has the capacity to grapple with and solve the largest problems of our era, and whether our democracy can do so staying within the zone of liberal democracy and not traversing those lines, remains an open question.
Well, Martin Mazower isn't saying that France and Germany and England are likely to stop being democracy. He's talking about some of the more troubled countries, isn't he?
He's talking about Greece. He's talking about Spain. He's
countries that have had histories along those lines.
And he's talking about East and Central Europe as well.
Now, your book has come out just after the Supreme Court has heard arguments in the case that would overturn parts of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. Are these issues still very much alive and not part of our history?
Well, I think they remain central constituents of our current affairs.
And how do you see current conservatism in relation to what was going on in the New Deal? Is it just a matter of the transfer from one party to another, or are there bigger themes here?
Well, in the late 1940s, Southern Democrats, fearful of change, discovered they could make alliance with Republicans and reciprocally, Republicans on such questions as labor discovered they could make alliance with the Southern Democrats. And that it wasn't quite right to call it a conservative alliance then as much as an alliance of convenience. But over time, with the transformations in the politics of the country and the South in particular, in the post-Civil Rights era, that is, post-Civil Rights Act era, the Republican Party has come to fill that vacuum.
Ira Katznelson will be giving a reading and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble store on 82nd Street. His book, his latest, is Fear Itself, The New Deal and the Origins of Our Time. It is published by the Liverite imprint of W.W. Norton. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you for having me.
On tomorrow's show, Shireen El-Fekky on how upheaval in the Arab world hasn't been confined to the streets. It appears to have worked its way into the bedrooms as well. And then Tony Award winners Bill Irwin and David Shiner discuss their off-Broadway play Old Hats. Ruth Urzecki on her latest novel called The Tale for the Time Being. And with March Madness on the horizon, legendary basketball coach Bob Knight talks about the power of negative thinking. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan's the executive producer. Debbie Darcher was at the audio controls. And we had help today from Hugh Sansom, Todd McGovern, Brittany Mania, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.